Welcome to Let's Talk Land, a weekly land education talk show devoted to learning about land and farms, buying and selling, and ownership, especially for the real estate agents and realtors. Learn from the experts. Free land education. Hi, my name's Lou Jewell. I'm an accredited land consultant, broker, owner of United Country Real Estate, Land Pro, along with Arnold Nelson, buying and selling homes, land and farms in Western Piedmont, North Carolina, or Southern Virginia. Just give us a shout. We'll help you out. Our office is located at 3349 Cook School Road in Pilot Mountain, North Carolina, Highway 52, exit 136 across from Foothills Hardware and Building Supply. We share offices with POP Design for all your graphic needs. Our company website is www.mylandpro.com. Our guest today is Daniel Wagner and Keith Lampe. Welcome, guys.
Hey.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Lou.
So you're just, what, north, a little north of Chicago?
You know, we're about 20 miles west of Chicago
west.
In Oak Brook, Illinois.
Oak Brook, okay. Beautiful brown soil up there.
Illinois has some good soil, you're right.
Yeah,
we're pretty
it does.
Proud of our farmers here in Illinois.
Absolutely. Let me kind of introduce you guys. Daniel, you know, you were on a show with me earlier in the year. We talked about conservation, and we'll talk about the Inman Group because you guys are incredibly large company and with a lot of capabilities. But
50 years history. Yep, 50
yeah.
year history.
So, Daniel, you're actually the Senior Vice President of Government Relationships for the Inman Group in Oak
yes.
Brook, Illinois, and Keith is the President of the Inland Capital Corporation. Daniel's been licensed as a real estate broker since 2004, also holds the Series 7 and 63 security license. You have numerous real estate and government boards and committees. You gave me about 8 pages of resume, so.
You know, my mom made that up for me, so
evidently.
You know. She loves it.
Yeah.
You don't have to read it all.
I'm sure she's got it mounted on the wall.
She does. I'm a baby of 7, so I'm a mama's boy. What can I say?
But you're currently the president-elect for the Illinois State Association, correct?
No, I'm not. I have triplets.
Ah, that's right. Triplets.
Yep. And so I resigned my position for my family.
Wow. Triplets. I can't
it's
imagine.
A crazy world. You know, we have the triplets are 17, and I have another guy who's 16, and one of our triplets is in the special needs universe. So I've recalibrated and focused more time on my family and
yep.
work here in Inland.
No problem there. I totally understand. You've also been a member of the International Council of Shopping Centers.
Yeah.
Marketplace Fitness Act. What is that?
Marketplace Fitness Act, it's where you have the online folks don't have to collect the sales tax, but the brick and mortar do. And actually, we just got resolution with the Supreme Court recently where now everybody online has to collect the sales tax just like brick and mortar. So it brings a fairness to the marketplace. In some areas, you'd have a possible 10% swing in the differences between products, and it's just based on tax, so that's unfair. So for the brick and mortar that provide all the incredible experiences for a local community to hire people to make sure to take care of the Kiwanis Club or Girl Scouts or and where else do you go to get your grandkid or your kid to sit on Santa Claus's lap?
Yeah,
you do
really.
That at a brick and mortar store, you know?
Absolutely. So the Amazon's and the internet shopping, is that affecting that at all?
Oh, clearly, that you know, we've seen lots of impact with that. Bookstores, you know, Borders is out of business. I think Barnes & Noble are hanging on by their fingernails because just the cost differences were, you know, just with that tax, that there's not a lot of margins there, so it hurts it. So, yeah, you see it a lot.
You're also a member of the Institute of Portfolio Alternatives Public Affairs Committee, which
yes.
is part of the Real Estate Roundtable. And thank you for doing that. That's all pro bono, I know. And you know, all the people in our real estate industry, it's incredible the amount of time and sacrifice that a few make for a whole lot. And
well, thank you, Lou. It's, you know, really, I work for Dan Goodwin, and he's the founder with three other founders, Joe Cosenza, Bob Baum, and
right.
Bob Parks.
Right.
And those guys, they're the ones that give me the opportunities to do all these things. And they are really here, Inland's here, and my position is to help the industry and help make sure our real estate community thrives.
Thank you for your service.
Thank you.
The board member of the Civic Federation of Chicago is active in the Illinois Chamber of Commerce, Illinois Manufacturing Association, Illinois Merchants Association, and the United States Chamber of Commerce. I mean, do you sleep at night? I mean,
you know, these guys keep me hopping in all these different positions, and we get these coalitions together, and you just never know who you're going to be connected with. We're a real estate company, but here in Illinois, the Illinois retail merchants, Illinois manufacturers, Illinois Chamber, they all are really strong. And then nationally, we're super involved with the National Association of Realtors, which is so powerful. And the other group that's so super powerful is the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And
right.
When you're dealing with crazy regulatory stuff in Washington, like the remember the crazy Waters of the U.S. Act that they put out there to...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you had to get a permit because you have a mud hole on your property. I mean, just crazy stuff like that. It's our job, Lou, to get the bucket of cold water and throw it on these folks in Washington and let them know that how real stuff is happening in the trenches. And that's the bottom line of our economy, right?
So you interact a lot with our good friend Russell Riggs, I guess, who's our head lobbyist for the Realtors Land Institute.
Oh, good guy. Yeah, oh, yeah. Oh, again, impeccable staff all the way around from, you know, the ICE, the International Council of Shopping Centers, the National Association of Realtors, the Realtors Land Institute. Aubrey is just incredible, who's the CEO of the Realtors Land Institute. She is phenomenal. And, of course, all of us love the fact that Bob Turner is going to become the commercial liaison for the National Association.
Yeah, I heard about that. He's on his way to Boston, or was this morning, I think.
He is. Oh, he is. And by gosh, if that guy can, he is not an introverted guy. He's
no.
going to make sure to get stuff done.
I met Bob years ago when I was taking one of my RLI classes in Memphis, and I'll never forget. You know, once you meet him, he's your friend for life, and has been all these years, and really turned our Realtors Land Institute management around. Unbelievable. I mean, like a 360 from a you are me to a you and me format, and and got money back in circulation, and we're just very strong now, looking to grow further.
Well, Aubrey Coburnus is a terrific person.
Absolutely.
A great executive director, and RLI is blessed to have her.
And our staff, too. Listen, I've had...
Oh, Of course.
The best. I say they're the best at NAR. Totally. Hey, Norm, you want to introduce Keith for us?
Yes. Keith, this is Arnold Nelson. How are you doing today?
Doing great, thanks. Thanks for having me.
I guess for purposes and everything, did your mom write your description or your resume?
Did your mom write your description like they like Dan's did?
that's kind of part of the process here at Inland. Yeah. We have our mothers right here, our fathers.
That's great. I'm baby boy also. Keith, I see where you have served as Director and Chief Operating Officer of Inland Private Capital Corporation since 2012 and the President effective 2015. You helped to shape the IPC into a market leader in private real estate securities industry. As President of IPC, you're responsible for directing the company's strategic growth plans while ensuring the Inland's core principles, including its investor-focused approach, are reflected throughout the organization. During the career of Mr. Lamp, you've been involved in over $6 billion in real estate transactions.
Have you done that much, Arnold?
Whoa.
Huh?
No.
Are you getting close?
Next year.
Okay.
Next year I should top that. Wow, you should know definitely what the 1031s is. across retail. So I understand you said that, I think Daniel said earlier, the retail and the rental and everything in your area of Illinois throughout the country is fantastic currently, correct?
It has. I mean, that's been an active segment for us over the years. I should, qualify that, $6 billion in transactions, that's spread across a fair amount of years. We've actually been we've been doing this, identifying property or opportunities within the real estate arena, and then bringing them, packaging them, bringing that product to market for 1031 exchange investors.
Right.
For just under 20 years now, so we've been active in a lot of different sectors. Retail has been one of the early active sectors we participated pretty heavily in.
Wow, I'd say your knowledge of the 1031 exchange has been instrumental in most of these sales. You think so?
Well, it's been an interesting evolution. You know, Section 1031's been on the books, been a part of the tax code for close to 100 years now.
Back in the 20s.
Back in the 20s, right. But the area we play in is what's oftentimes referred to as the securitized 1031
yes.
exchange market. And what that effectively means is, you know, rather than a property owner selling a piece of investment property and then going out buying another piece of investment property and owning 100% of what they sold and 100% of what they buy, that's kind of your pure play 1031.
Right.
Securitized exchanges, what it accomplishes is it allows companies like Inland to go out and buy a larger, more institutional-sized property
right.
on behalf of investors. We package it in a way where an investor coming to the table with $200,000, $300,000
right.
can own a fractional interest in a larger piece of property. And so the difference between a regular 1031 and a securitized exchange is really that fractionalized ownership. Structure, and that's a newer right. area. That's
yes.
an area that's around a little under 20 years old. And early on, when the IRS was providing guidance surrounding kind of how to structure and how to package these vehicles,
right.
there was a pretty wide learning curve. There was a lot of wrinkles that needed to be ironed out, and Inland was instrumental in kind of blazing that trail,
right.
making sure the industry grew organically and systemically, and that we grew the right way. And you know, fast forward to today, this is a very vibrant industry, and it's a very important component to exchange investing because it allows investors that were active property owners
right.
to still defer their capital gains, still accomplish what you know the powerful tool of Section 1031, but accomplish it in a way of getting out of active and into a more passive ownership type vehicle.
Right. Would this be kind of similar to REIT, Real Estate Investment Trust? Has it got some similarities to that?
That's a good question. You know, with actually quite a bit different about
right.
the product we offer is, you know, the IRS came out with guidance in the early 2000s surrounding how these fractionalized ownership vehicles should take root
right.
or take form. But one of the things that they were quick to point out is for real estate to be considered like-kind, it
right.
has to be directly owned. So direct ownership of investment property has to be that common theme.
Right.
And when you look at limited partnership structures or real estate investment trust structures, those are more, the ownership structure is more of owning shares of stock or shares in a security, and that does not qualify as like-kind. So we, as
right.
an industry, went through great pains to figure out how can we package a piece of property in such a way where investors directly own their undivided ownership interest so that it still qualifies
right.
as like-kind under the
right.
tax provision. And that's essentially what we had to kind of wrestle with early on in the early 2000s. And now it's, you know, coming out the other side, it's become a very, you know, broad-spanning, heavily tested kind of product that checks all the appropriate boxes. But back to your question, ownership of stock in a REIT,
right.
that would not qualify as like-kind real estate because you don't actually directly own the property. You own stock
right.
in a company that owns the property. That's kind of the differentiating theme.
Right.
Okay, we're talking with our good friend Dan Wagner and Keith Lampe with Arnold Nelson and Lou Jewell, and Let's Talk Land.
Yes, sir. Keith, this is Arnold Nelson again, and to finish up your description and everything, board directors of ADISA, ADISA. Could you kind of elaborate on that a little bit?
Absolutely, yeah. ADISA has been another great association that the Inland Group has been a part of. In fact, we were one of the founding members of the association back when it was referred to as TICA. So it's kind of gone through a couple of name changes. Initially, the association was formulated with the mindset surrounding bringing together industry types that were active in and participated in the securitized 1031 exchange market. As it grew and evolved, it began to expand and open up its doors to other real estate-related platforms and anybody that participated in the real estate world. And then it recently broadened its horizons yet again and ultimately encapsulates all things alternative investments. So non-traded, non-listed securities, all of these different walks of life come together and network and collaborate on different advocacy topics.
Right.
And it's really just a great association. It's one of the largest in the alternative space. And I should have said earlier, ADISA stands for Alternative and Direct Investment Securities Association. So that kind of gets to the heart of what the association stands for. And Inland's been a very big supporter of it since it was founded back in 2006.
Wow, it's amazing to me. You know, I always heard alternative financing and coming up that you've created some of these things that, you know, to get people kind of invested similar to a REIT. And it says mentions about scholarships. Could you kind of elaborate on that and special projects?
Yeah, there's a various committees that, kind of drive the success and growth of the association. And one of the areas that we've been focusing on as a board of directors and as a leadership right. group is, you know, ways to give back. To give back to the community and you know, make ultimately the world a better place. And
yes.
The ADISA Foundation was formed several years back. Its focus in recent years has been to raise capital from different charitable constituents so that we could provide a scholarship program that helped and aided the education and study of students that are looking to get into the financial services. The
right.
financial planning arena within the subset of the business major. So that has been a great feature that ADISA has been actively involved in, and
right.
I've been working alongside them on that initiative for the past
yeah.
couple of years.
That's great.
Yeah, you got an award too. Real Estate Forum magazine. You were in 2013 the top 40 under 40. Congratulations on that. That's quite an honor.
Oh, thank you. You know, and he gave me his autograph, and it's worth a lot of money.
Which wall is it hanging on?
It's right by his desk.
Perfect, wow. Perfect. With, I'm sure, a few more like yours, Dan.
Right.
So you, Mr. Lampe, you received a bachelor's degree in economics from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. You hold a Series 7, a 24, 63, 79, and a 99. License with FINRA. What's FINRA?
FINRA. FINRA is the, you know, all of the licenses speak to the fact that the product, while the underlying asset class is real estate, we structure and package and ultimately sell products through financial planners that are securities licensed.
Right.
All of our actions are kind of governed by the regulatory bodies of both FINRA and the Securities and Exchange Commission. So we kind of view that as an added layer of scrutiny that provides an investor protection in that, you know, when we sell a product that has real estate attached to it, it's not a buyer beware type of transaction. This is a fully disclosed, you know, we play a fiduciary role and responsibility in delivering the value associated with the projections we put forth. And it's added protection for investors, which I think is important in this day and age.
Absolutely. I many, many years ago, I used to sell numismatic coins, U.S. tangibles in Dallas back in the, I think it started in 84, 85, you know, when we had the 18% interest were coming out of it, and you'd turn to USA News and, you know, you'd see that stocks were a minus and other investments were, you know, 1%, 2%, and numismatic coins was 54%, and I ran into a guy that was doing historical rehabs out in Kansas, and he wanted me to get my, at that time, Series 22 license, which I went to New York and spent a week and got my license, and then Mr. Reagan came in, and TR-86 took effect, and they disallowed it. So, so that's been my luck with securities. Let's talk about the Inland Real Estate Companies. I've got a whole list of stuff, but you're the guys that best would tell us about it. You said they're 50 years old, and you got multiple companies. Can we go?
Well, this is one of my favorite topics. This organization was created by four teachers who came from nothing.
Four teachers? What kind of teachers?
Well, I know, like, Mr. Goodwin, he's the chairman and CEO of the board. He is he was a middle school teacher, high school teacher.
Really?
And he taught for 5 years. And during the summers, he would get these other, you know, his friends and family and other teachers to invest in doing real estate deals. And he and three other teachers came together, and they formed Inland 50 years ago. And it's the, you know, the concept of we're in land, and that's where they got the name. But they went from just nothing to where, if there's a Guinness Book of World Records for giving out an award for doing the most individual commercial real estate deals in America, our Joe Costanza, who's the president of our acquisitions division, would have that.
Wow.
We have created, we incubate companies. We've created real estate investment trusts, a variety of them, where they start off as non-traded REITs, and then we go and make them traded, and they go public. We have a really successful development company that goes out there and put together apartments in Colorado Springs, Tampa, it's all over the place. And then we've become experts in finance. So we have a home mortgage business, Inland Home Mortgage. It does about $600 million a year in home mortgages.
Wow.
And we have a bank, and the bank smaller does about $1.3 billion of assets. And then we have a second bank. And then we have mezzanine loan financing. So a variety of different companies that make an impact really across the country. We've actually purchased in every state except Alaska. And we gotta find the right thing. But it's pretty interesting with over, I think, 500,000 investors. Inland is really just a top-notch company. And, boy, when you look at some of the awards our company's received, there's just too numerous today. But one of the things I'm proud of is getting the Better Business Bureau Ethics Torch Award, not just for 1 year, but for 3 years. And we're the first real estate company to ever get that.
Wow.
So it's pretty cool to see all that. And, of course, these four teachers, again, coming from nothing, they all give back in different parts of society. You know, we have Inland created the New Directions. Mr. Goodwin created the New Directions nonprofit, where he has over $100 million in affordable housing apartments for the working poor. And the National Association of Realtors actually gave him the Good Neighbor Award for his efforts and what he does to help with affordable housing for people.
Sure,
so
well deserved.
It's pretty exciting to see the different aspects, but we all learn from them. And Keith can tell you about how really these teachers, they created this this whole industry of the Delaware Statutory Trust.
Yeah, let's hear about it.
Yeah, it's really, it kind of dovetails into everything Dan described. And you know, our company, when our division or corporation within the Inland family was really more of an idea than an actual corporation, you know, not less than two decades ago. And one of the reasons that it thrived and continued to expand and grown as a market leader is because we were able to leverage the resources and knowledge base that the principals and the broader Inland brand had. So I mentioned earlier in some of my remarks that during the early 2000s, the IRS provided guidance that really sort of was beginning to shape an industry, beginning to dictate how these fractionalized 1031 exchange products were going to be developed, distributed, and how they were going to work for investors. And, you know, a lot of great care was taken to make sure that the structure fit within the parameters the IRS set forth. And Inland was instrumental in working with some really bright tax minds with various law firms in you know, spending dollars and committing resources to further the progress and understanding and development of this product line, because we saw such an incredible need and demand from investors that wanted access to the product that didn't quite exist yet. And you know, through tireless energy and commitment, like many of the other product lines that have grown into successful platforms, our 1031 division was kind of the benefactor of that. And it's been a really positive kind of path that we've been marching upon ever since. So,
well, and the other thing about the Keith's in charge of, you might talk, Keith, about what happened during the downturn, during the recession, and what happened to the industry, and where did Inland stand with the industry?
Well, you know, as they say in life, timing is everything, and, you know, the securitized 1031 market was really still in its early kind of infancy stages when this financial downturn occurred, which was pretty deep rooted and had a real estate undertone attached to it, right? Because it's a financial driven market correction, market downturn, and real estate was impacted, you know, across pretty much every segment. Lenders weren't lending, property owners weren't selling, or if they didn't have to, and so transaction volume kind of got locked in, and the timing couldn't have been worse for a newly growing industry that had just kind of hit its stride. And so we did see a downward phenomenon in terms of the amount of investors that were selling highly appreciated properties looking to complete a tax-deferred exchange. And one of the things we observed was this marketplace, Inland was one of, I think, 70, 75 different companies bringing tax-deferred exchange products to the market. And when the music came close to stopping in 2009 and 2010, a lot of those companies either intentionally went away or in some instances financially went out of business. But one of the reasons we're still here to talk about it today was Inland was able to draw upon experience, financial resources, in some instances anchor on the fact that we selected the right assets, structured them with a long-term game plan, long-term mindset, and we were really able to come out of the financial downturn and out the other side even stronger than we were during the days leading in. And in some respects, I refer to that the financial crisis as it was a cleansing of our industry. It was kind of a recalibration of sorts. But, you know, now that we're back to that point in time where we're seeing an industry hit its stride, we're seeing a lot of demand from investors that need this product. You know, I oftentimes remind people of that story because this is like any other business and industry. You can play the long game or the short game. Inland's always been very long-term minded. We're committed to businesses. We're committed to growing businesses. And ultimately, we're committed to our investors long-term. I don't think you can be in business for 50 years without having that mindset. And that's in my mind, an important attribute to looking at this as a viable growing industry and furthering that progress long-term.
And let me add to that, you guys. What the interesting aspect of the 1031 is the history that 1031 has had with Inland's history, because with these teachers created all of these limited partnerships, and that's how we really grew. They grew the company. When the tax laws changed in the 80s, all that stuff, obviously there's not all of it, but a lot, you know, variety of it was upside down. And this just shows you what kind of caliber of people who run this company are. They said they're not going to let people lose their original investment with Inland. You know, they know these people. They're their parents and relatives and other teachers and principals they know. So they put their money back into the company, and they went to Walmart, and they, you know, Joe Cosenza, that they went and verified with Walmart that we purchased these Walmarts and became the largest landlord for Walmart and did these sale leasebacks, and 1031 all of the bad partnerships that were upside down into these good Walmarts, and people were just shocked that these guys didn't walk away from them, and they put their own money into it. And it's kind of like it's a wonderful life story in a way. You don't,
right.
That just doesn't happen. And so these folks are in charge of this whole ship of Inland, and it's just an honor to work for people like that.
Absolutely.
Because it really is part of everything that we are and who we are. Ethics is what we are all about, and we didn't make that up. It's just this is our culture.
We're talking to Daniel Wagner and Keith Lampe with the Inland Group, and this is Arnold Nelson and Lou Jewell. Let's talk land. So we're talking about our topic today is the 1031 DST. The DST acronym is for the Delaware Statutory Trust. Is this part of that new the 2017 tax bill, or has this been around?
It's been around a little while.
Okay.
Now, what's interesting about the DST is its popularity, and it's effectively becoming the mainstay kind of in vogue structure for putting together 1031 exchange vehicles, really didn't manifest until after the economic downturn. But the DST was actually it was an outgrowth of a IRS revenue ruling that occurred back in 2004. And what we, so early on in our marketplace, the TIC, or tenant in common vehicle, was commonly used. And the TIC vehicle was an effective way to bring fractionalized ownership to investors looking to execute a 1031 exchange. But there were a lot of restrictions associated with it. The DST structure is, again, you referred to a Delaware statutory trust. And effectively what we can accomplish by utilizing a DST is you take a piece of property, title is held in trust, so the Delaware statutory trust holds title to the property, and then you bring investors in underneath the trust and they get an assignment of beneficial interest in the trust. So they own their fractionalized ownership directly in the trust, and it creates a lot of simplifying attributes from an administrative standpoint, which make for better pricing on interest rates, make for more efficient cost structure associated with offering this product. So the first concept I'll touch on is if you buy a property and you want to obtain a loan, the lender can look at a Delaware statutory trust, and rather than have to worry about making that loan to 100 different investors, they'll look at the piece of property, they'll look at the trust, they'll say, who's the signatory trustee behind the trust? In this instance, it would be Inland, and they can give you institutional type pricing the same way they would price the asset if it were going into a pension fund,
right,
or a real estate investment trust or any other type of institutional vehicle. So what it does is it streamlines the lending process so that our investors can have the same benefits that your larger scale institutional buyers of real estate would have the luxury of. And that's just one attribute associated with the structure. But in a nutshell, and you may have questions here for me, Lou, but
that's fine.
In a nutshell, the DST is a holding vehicle that allows investors to come in and own a fractionalized interest directly in real property so that it qualifies as like-kind real estate when they're looking to complete their Section 1031.
So it says that, and just in my research, Arnold and I found that it says most of the users is smaller baby boomer investors who real estate's not their primary business. They might want to own rental homes or two, or multifamily property, even small office building, retail centers. All require at least some, and if not, active management. So reaching retirement age, many of the investors are looking to cash out on their real estate investment, so the tax deferred comes into that, of course, so they can move it from one vehicle to the other. Now, just to go back a little bit, what changed significantly as far as real estate in the 1031, the 2017 loss? I know you can't call it personal now, or they changed the
family deductions.
Yeah, right. It was the exclusion of personal property. So there were elements of Section 1031 whereby an investor could accomplish a like-kind exchange by selling certain types of personal property.
Coins, airplanes, boats, fur coats.
So all of that was carved out, and there was an exclusion. Real estate remained intact. So real estate was the one asset type that was kind of left in Section 1031 of the code. And Dan, I know you...
Yeah, and so the big deal for farmers, and I probably don't have to tell you this, is the equipment was excluded for that. And,
right.
And so, but right now, immediate expensing has been the savior. But that goes away in about 4 or 5 years.
It's a scale down. Yeah,
it's a scale down, right? And so, and I'm sure you know it more than I do. But that's the big thing that impacts the farm industry. And I know that the ag lobbyists did a really good job, and this immediate expensing. Hopefully, they'll continue it and they'll extend that.
Right.
When you talk about tax reform, the thing that's that always scares me is when Congress is in session.
Really?
I like it when they're not in session, so I feel more secure with my wallet. So with tax reform 2.0, we always have to keep one eye out for when they look at wanting to find something to pay for something. We always have to keep an eye out to see how this will be.
There was something like $1.5 trillion I was looking at today that's being deferred right now, or is that does that sound right?
We want everybody to do that with Inland.
Yeah, really, $1.5 trillion.
Keith,
you know, I would suggest that Keith does talk about what happens with estate planning and the DS.
Yeah, definitely. You got a question, Arnold?
Yes, Keith, Dan, I know primary residence to primary residence is not allowed under 1031, correct?
That's correct. It's investment property for investment property, so your primary residence is excluded. Although there's primary residence, other tax attributes to selling and gains being deferred on certain amounts, certain thresholds on the primary residence. But for Section 1031, it has to be investment property for investment property.
All right. You mentioned farm properties. A farm property that was, say, someone had owned for years. They had got rental income off of their crops. Is that allowed under 1031 if they went and bought something and they rented it for income, used it personally some? What would be the exclusions to that? Is that allowable?
I'm sorry. I didn't catch that.
I'm sorry. Can you hear me now?
No.
How about now?
No, he's just saying if you're a farmer and you've got your home, but you got your farm separately, make an income off of it. Now you want to exchange it, right?
Right.
So what's the question?
All right. Is that allowable if you exchange it, say, for a secondary home or something, but you also get rental income off of it, based on limitations? It's considered an investment. Is that feasible, allowable under 1031?
Yeah, so we do see this with business owners from time to time, or even somebody that has a rental property attached to their primary residence.
Yes.
And ultimately what we have to do is sit down and work with a tax professional, work with a CPA, determine what portion of your sales price would be exchangeable and what portion would be attributable to your primary residence, and then kind of separate to just making sure that from a tax planning standpoint, if you were executing on a portion of that sale through Section 1031, that portion actually qualified as, for that particular treatment.
So Arnold, for example, he's quite invested in land, buying and selling for a number of years, and that's our relationship. So let's say, I sell one of his tracts of land for $300,000 or $400,000, and he decides he wants to do a 1031 on that because it is investment property, and go buy some apartment units. So all that's still available.
Yep, that works. I mean, land for apartments, it's coincidental. I think people get hung up on the word like-kind, and they think that would work. But again, like-kind is pretty liberal, and all it really is meant to imply is it's got to be investment property for investment property. So if you held your land for investment and you're buying an apartment for investment purposes, that's considered a like-kind exchange.
And then for farmers, these DSTs are a godsend because it helps you be able to make this a passive investment.
Right.
You retire and you get into this. And what, Keith? How does that work? How do they get their money? What's it?
It's very. The product. The reason this is a product that's bought and not sold is because you have a large number of investors looking to get out of active ownership into passive. And from a distribution standpoint, Inland takes the onus of doing property management, asset management. We finance the property. We do everything. It's a turnkey solution.
Right.
So from an investor's perspective, they invest their capital in one of our programs, and then they get monthly distributions, which are tied to the rental income associated with that particular property. And it's oftentimes the tongue-in-cheek reference is it's mailbox money. It's a passive role. You sit back and you collect your distributions after you make the investment rather than having to put sweat equity into actively managing a property.
And Keith will tell you, how long do we normally keep those properties, and what happens with that?
I mean, our objective, this is real estate. We're buying stabilized, typically cash flowing properties. So we underwrite most programs thinking about it as a 10-year hold. We'll typically lock in our financing for that similar period of time, locking in our interest rate for 10 years, and then we build out a property reserve account to make sure we can manage any outside unforeseen capital expenditures associated with with managing properties. There are plenty of instances where we'll see an opportunity to sell an asset prior to that 10-year time horizon, but typically we're looking at every property we buy today as being a 10-year hold period.
And to get this property, or to get this DST, can you tell the accredited investor is what they have?
I mentioned earlier, this is when you buy into a fractionalized ownership piece of real estate, even though it's direct ownership, it has that turnkey proposition, which means you have a sponsor like Inland doing the property management, the asset management. We have a fiduciary role in the transaction. By definition, this falls into the category of a security.
Right.
So by securities rules, these are private placements. They're not registered. They're called Regulation D private placements. So the accredited investor threshold, the qualification is you have to have $1 million net worth exclusive of primary residence in order to participate in one of these programs. Or if you don't have that net worth but you're looking at qualifying under the income exemption, if you have $200,000 a year annually or $300,000 if you're filing jointly, you can also qualify under the income threshold.
Dan and Keith, what is the average rate of return? I know it's different on the real estate investors. I believe you said you had over 500,000 private investors.
That's a good question. A lot of these are income-generating products, and it really, a lot of it will depend on where a property is located from a geographic standpoint, what sector or strategy you're participating in. So, the rates of return, by example, that student housing properties might generate is going to be very different from the rate that self-storage properties generate.
According to the risk.
But on average, we're typically seeing cap rates in the real estate market for stabilized properties, in the low to mid five.
Right.
And that's really typically the typical metric that will correlate with the target cash-on-cash return
right.
An investment.
Could you also highlight what happens, for an estate planning? How does that work?
So, estate planning is a big component to the long-term thought and planning proposition that investors and their financial advisors will kind of think about. So, many investors that are completing 1031 exchanges, by the time they get to us, it may not even be their first exchange. They may have done a series of prior 1031 exchanges, and then they decide to get out of active passive ownership, and they do a subsequent exchange. The way the tax law is written currently, upon death, the ownership transfers to their heirs at a step-up in cost basis. So, depending on what age or what point in an investor's life cycle they may be when they participate in an additional tax-deferred exchange, many investors are thinking about it as, I've deferred a lot of gain, I've built wealth, and I've made return on investment on dollars that would have otherwise been paid out in taxes, and if I liquidate, I have to settle up, and I ultimately have to do the calculation in terms of what I would owe upon liquidation.
Right.
If I continue to defer, and upon death, I pass that ownership to my heirs at a step-up basis, and that is effectively a very powerful estate planning.
Hey, I got a question. The abolishment of the death tax, how is that affecting any of this stuff?
It would definitely factor into a lot of these estate planning discussions, and it would have a lot of those undertones. And I think there are different strategies that could likely be employed, and probably be a better question for somebody with direct tax expertise.
Okay.
But I think at a high level, the step-up in cost basis, irrespective of the recent changes, is still a very prevalent thought process in the estate planning arena.
Okay.
And Keith, the DSTs, how many products do you have out there now?
At any given point in time, one of the objectives or goals that we've always kind of aspired to accomplish is to have diversity for investors to look at anytime they have a property that they're selling and they're going into cash. We recognize that it's not a one-size-fits-all proposition. What might work well for one investor might not work as well for another investor. So our goal is to have different asset types, different offerings that capture different strategies, different leverage points.
Leverage is a big deal. That's a great point.
Yeah, there's an element in 1031 exchange investing that requires you to match, not only reinvest your equity, but also match debt that you paid off when you sell. So at any given point in time, we like to have typically 4 to 6 different programs for investors to pick and choose from, thinking along the lines of, you know, an investor may have $400,000, $500,000, $600,000 in investable equity, and they may diversify that across numerous programs and build their own portfolio of fractional interest, as opposed to putting all their eggs in one basket.
How does the DST relate to the TIC program, the Tenet and Comet structure that came out a number of years ago?
Great question.
Great question. If you peel back different layers of the onion, there's actually a lot of differences in the structure, which you could probably take up a whole other call going through the differences.
We can do it.
But I'll say at a high level is that the TIC and the DST are both along a similar vein in that they allow an investor to come into a fractionalized ownership vehicle, have it be considered like kind, and have access to a larger property. I think the biggest difference that I'll highlight on this call is the TIC structure limits the amount of investors that can go into one property to 35. So okay. If you have a $70 million property and you have a 50% loan on it, so you have $35 million in equity to raise, at 35 investors, your minimum buy-in is $1 million. With the DST, we can go up to 2,000 investors if we want it. Now, we never come anywhere close, but what it allows us to do is lower our minimum. So the average standard minimum investment with DST is typically $100,000. So what it does in a nutshell is it encourages diversification. That same investor that would have had to put $1 million in one program just to meet the minimum can diversify that across numerous DSTs, spread their risk from a geographic, from a sector and strategy perspective, and that's probably the biggest outward-facing difference in the structure that I would probably highlight in response to the question.
Wow.
And, you know, you don't have to – the big deal is the rogue investor. You don't have to worry about the rogue investor stopping really a logical continuity for how you manage the property. And when you have these experts here at Inland who managed up for 50 years, you got the experts instead of people that don't really know what they're doing.
Wow. Keith and Dan, I love the way you described the creative financing. I think that's your niche and everything, and the way the teachers come together. I guess the public retirement, our teachers' retirement, and public employees in Illinois is kind of in the red, so that was a real smart move.
Yeah. That's you can say that again. Yeah, I could. 100 and some billion.
I see where you. I can see that's amazing what you've managed to do with this company. Do you see any clouds on the horizon? I can tell, by the way you run and the financing you got, investors and all, do you see any other banks or things getting in trouble with derivatives or anything like it started, in 2008 and 9? Do you see anything, any warning signs on the horizon of that? Of course, I know you're going to be ahead of it, but you're stronger position than you was when it happened before. Do you see any signs whatsoever, clouds on the horizon of people getting in trouble, or banks, or going back to cooking the books and stuff.
My crystal ball is no better than any of the Wall Street analysts that cover banks and cover the general health of kind of the financial institutions that pump the blood through the system in terms of lending.
Right.
But I can say specific to the real estate market, and I've been a student of kind of observing behavioral trends that are isolated within our niche.
Right.
And that is, I think when you look at the leverage point that investment managers and investors are taking on, and in some respects, I think this is dictated by banks, I think the programs that we're seeing structured today are at a lower leverage point than they were at the peak of the last market cycle. I think that underscores and maybe demonstrates some of the discipline and some of the thinking that's gone into taking a little bit less risk, being a little bit longer behind it. And that to me, if you want to compare kind of where we are today to maybe where we were, in the mid-2000s, I see us, at least as a niche industry, on a much healthier footing.
Right.
I think there's a strong appetite from investors to lend, or from lenders to lend. There's a strong appetite for investors to invest. and there's ample deal flow out there. So everything appears fairly healthy at the moment. That's kind of a high level thought.
I got a question for you guys. When I was working through the financial planning industry as a wholesaler of numismatic coins, we always recommend that you had at that time 10% of your investment dollars in hard assets, whether they were gold stocks or gold bars or platinum or palladium, but that you diversified. What kind of, do you guys have a ratio like that, a percentage of your investment portfolio for your investments?
You know, the reality is that we don't get into that. It's individual, working with your financial advisor. And if we got into that, we would the Securities and Exchange Commission is like that.
That's
so
right.
Yeah, we wouldn't do that.
Yeah, sorry, I was thinking about non-securities, but anyway, okay, my bad.
No, but it is. It's really so much fun working for a company like this where
you guys gonna have a great time.
They created an industry. I mean, they went to Treasury and they got this DST created because ticks were so difficult to manage. And this product, like I said, is just phenomenal for farmers, especially where they could get out of it. They could go and it's a great way to retire if they want to get the family out of the farm. But my grandfather was a farmer, and so I go back to farm roots from Springfield, Illinois.
Yeah,
and they grew corn and soybeans, and they didn't do animals. But the family decided to get out of the business, and we did. But there's a lot of folks that this is their bread and butter. And God bless them, because America needs strong farming communities.
We need young farmers. We got to support all the programs to get these young farmers out there.
Absolutely,
our generations. I want to get a couple shows on some of these. You guys might can help me out with some connections, because I really advocate that. I know farm credit.
It's so important. And these young farmers, especially, not to take away from the older farmers, but they're really engaged in understanding the latest technology. And it blew my mind being on a farm with a friend who has GPS of where to spray the chemical into. It's wild. They know more about computers than most people would ever dream of.
It's I've interviewed a couple companies where this technology is just exploding, where they can produce better soils, better crops, quicker, faster, more efficient. There's a lot of technology, and it's been around the farming industry, but there's some new stuff out there that I don't have time to go into, but it's on our shows, past shows, if anybody's interested. But I do strongly, and I know Arnold does too, support these young farmer programs. And there's quite a few of them at the state level and the local level and at the national level too. Each of the governments have specific programs for education and stimulation of interest for these guys.
Absolutely. I think it's terrific to highlight that. And the more education that you can get out there, Lou, I think the better, because it's a wonderful way to raise a family. And, clearly can be with anything that's difficult, there's a lot of rewards. And there's so many intangible things that happen with the family farmer that I know I've seen in my family life.
Well, I've got my mother's family, great-granddaddy and great-great-granddaddy bought 18 farms between 1909 and 1929. And we're going on five generations now. Not one inch of that land has been sold except internally in the family. Like, mother inherited 100 acres and sold it to one of her brothers. But, we had the dairy farm, of course, the tobacco, corn, soy. And, so now we're into chicken houses. So, but it's fed our family and put them through school. And, it's not urban living. It's the real stuff, and you're dealing with weather and all kinds of things. So,
I make sure in raising kids too. The other thing is educating kids today about what the farmer does for you. And I love when I go to a restaurant, I tell the kids, "Oh, you like that bacon? Well, that's a pig." And you got to make sure they understand that.
Yeah, that's right.
God put these animals on the planet for us, and we take care of them, and they take care of us and feed us, and it's all a part of the circle of life, as you say, and it works out well.
We got about 5 minutes left, and we'll close out. What's the three things we want to leave people with today? Three important things.
The three things I think are the incredible stability of the Inland Real Estate Group, and that's, you know, that just what a great company is to fight for the real estate industry. I think what an incredible product the Delaware Statutory Trust is for people to get into passive investment if that's what they want to do. And then let's see, the DSC, and then how Inland created, you know, Inland created the DSC, the whole industry.
Are you there, guys?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Okay, fine. No, just cut off there for a second.
Okay.
And then, of course, you know, this is a land show, and I'm the land man. You know, what percentage of your products deal with just raw land?
Well, our products are not involved in just raw land. We are involved with apartments, and so that class,
sure,
that asset class is not part of what we do.
Okay.
Apartments, and we have medical office, some retail, self storage. Those would be the areas that we're into.
Perfect. Well, I want to have you guys back on. You know, I think we got some other things that we want to talk about. I really want to talk about some of these government, Dan, with you again on the show. And,
sure.
I know that you're on touch with that. And there's some, you know, with this election coming up, that's going to make some changes, hopefully, to the better. We don't know. I don't care who's in government or what they look like or what they say, as long as I can feed my family.
We call it the, you know, in the realtor world, we call it the realtor party, and
yeah,
it's probably the most nonpartisan organization that exists, where you have Democrats and Republicans coming together to fight for private property rights. And I got to tell you, it's more and more of the battle in Chicago. It is insane. People are talking about rent control. I mean, they'll just shut down all of the development in downtown Chicago if they do rent control.
Oh, yeah. There's some crazy thoughts out there. I don't know where they come from, but.
I love talking with you, Lou, and thank you, Arnold.
No,
yeah, thank you.
It's
Dan,
real,
and Keith.
Real pleasure to have you guys on.
Keith had to walk out.
How did they get in touch with you guys? I know on the website I put your email on there, if that's okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Put my email, and if you have any questions, call Dan Wagner at 630-218-4953.
And how about you, Keith?
Keith has stepped out.
Okay. You know his number. It's okay. I've got his email on the website.
Okay, great.
So, Rodney?
Yes, sir.
How do they get in touch with us?
Well, they can tune us in every Saturday morning for the Land Pro Show with Lou Jewell. Let's Talk Land. It's all happening Saturdays from 7 to 8. And also, they can download the Simple Radio app, or they can go to our website. Go to WKTE1090.com, click on there, and you can listen to the show anywhere in the world.
Wow, and so this is year number 5 that WKTE has been awarded the what?
The Station of the Year.
And it's Beach Music.
Beach and Oldies,
beach
yes.
Beach and Oldies. And
we're the number one station in the Triad area.
And they're meeting in at the beach next week. And
that's right.
Hopefully going to win this year, right?
We hope so.
Okay. All right. I'm counting on you.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today. Let us know how you like the show. If you have any questions or topics or would like to suggest, we'd appreciate it. All questions are welcome, and all our guests may be emailed with your questions or concerns as well. This show is for the public and, most importantly, for real estate agents who do not have a source of land education. All the shows are broadcast on Saturday mornings from 7 to 8 here on the station. And then a couple days later, we download it to my website, which is www.letstalkland.net. No apostrophe. letstalkland.net. You can also tune us in on Podbean, Spotify. We download on Facebook and YouTube and more. If you want to get in touch with me, my email is lou@mylandpro.com, and my cell is 336-669-1405. Another great show. Thanks, gentlemen. What a pleasure.
Thank you. This was great.